Have you ever, imagined what it would be like to be recruited for a mission that practically guaranteed you a target on your back?
Oh, man. No.
I mean, just picture sitting down for a briefing, right? And the commanding officer looks you dead in the eye and says, you will be hated, you will be hunted, and your own family might turn you in.
Yeah.
So, and by the way, pack absolutely nothing.
Right. It completely defies the way we usually think about recruitment or, well, starting any kind of new movement.
Exactly.
Usually you expect the pitch to highlight the benefits,
Yeah.
the glory, the ultimate victory, or at least like decent per diem.
Right, maybe some travel expenses covered. But instead, the pitch is just a promise of absolute inescapable danger.
Yeah.
And that brings us to the topic of today's deep dive. We are looking at a comprehensive summary of Matthew chapter 10.
This heavy one.
It really is. Our mission today is to strip away the the polished stained glass window versions of this ancient
Like
text.
the Sunday school versions.
Exactly. We want to plunge directly into the gritty historical context, the intense political tension, and the literal life or death drama of first century Judea that's presented in our source document.
It's just a fascinating document because it is as explosive as it is ancient. I mean, you are basically looking at a blueprint for a movement that was born in a geopolitical powder keg.
A total powder keg. And, because this text is so explosive and because it still carries massive religious and political weight today, we really need to set some ground rules for this deep
Oh,
dive.
definitely.
We aren't here to preach and we aren't here to take any modern political sides, either left or right. We are just putting on our historian hats to look strictly at the raw, volatile data in the source text.
Just sticking to the facts.
Right. We are here to understand what the text says, why it was so incredibly dangerous, and how it actually functioned on the ground in the first century.
Which is vital because, to understand the sheer weight of Matthew chapter 10, you really have to understand the world these people were waking up in every single day. Yeah, set the stage for us.
Well, first century Judea was a society completely on the broke. The Jewish people had been subjugated by the Roman Empire since 63 BCE.
Wow, so a long time.
Right. So by the time this text takes place, you have generations of people living under the heavy, watchful, and honestly, often brutal eyes of Roman rule.
It's a society entirely defined by a crushing military occupation.
Precisely. You've got figures like the Roman governor Pontius Pilate, representing the terrifying military might of Rome, and then client kings like Herod Antipas, trying to hold on to local regional power by just constantly appeasing the emperor.
Just doing whatever Rome wants.
Exactly. And beneath them, it is this highly stratified society. You have a massive population of rural peasants who are literally just trying to survive crushing taxation.
Right.
You have religious elites trying to maintain the purity of their faith while, navigating this hostile occupation. And then you have Roman sympathizers, locals, who basically decided the only way to survive was to cooperate with the oppressors. Okay, let's unpack this. Because if the Roman occupation is so absolute and frankly terrifying, how does a grassroots movement even begin to operate under that radar?
It's a great question.
To figure that out, we have to look at the incredibly strange parameters of the mission Jesus gave to his newly commissioned 12 disciples in this text.
Yeah, it's wild.
It really is. According to the document, they are granted this unbelievable divine authority. They're told to cast out demons, heal the sick, and proclaim that the kingdom of heaven is at
Which
hand.
is a massive mandate.
A completely massive mandate. But then the logistical parameters just get wild. He orders them to travel totally unburdened.
Yep.
They are explicitly told to take no money, no extra clothes, no provisions, not even a bag.
Nothing at all.
Nothing. They have to rely entirely on the hospitality of total strangers. This is like sending an elite, unarmed task force into hostile territory with a zero budget, no luggage whatsoever, and intentionally restricting their map to the absolute most difficult demographic.
Right, because of the restrictions.
Yeah, because that's the other wild restriction here. Verses 5 and 6 specifically say, "Go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town to the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." I mean, why on earth would you use such a bizarre, restrictive strategy? If you have a message to spread, wouldn't you want to shout it from the rooftops to everyone?
Well, what's fascinating here is the massive prophetic weight behind those specific choices. The restriction isn't like a limitation of the message's power, it's a statement of its purpose.
Okay, how so?
Well, the number 12 isn't random at all. Choosing exactly 12 disciples was a deeply symbolic, inescapable declaration to anyone watching. It signified the restoration of the 12 tribes of Israel.
Wait, but if it's about national identity, why limit it just to the lost sheep? I mean, wouldn't you want to announce that to the Romans, too, to show you're taking your country back?
Because Jesus is establishing that this restoration had to happen on a spiritual level first, you know, before any broader global expansion could take place.
Oh, I see.
By bypassing the Gentile and Samaritan territories initially, the mission was hyper-focused on calling the house of Israel back to their spiritual roots. It was basically an internal house cleaning.
And the lack of money or luggage?
That wasn't just about asceticism or being tough. By arriving with absolutely nothing, the disciples were forcing a choice upon the towns they entered. They had to be invited in.
Ah, they had to be welcomed.
Right. The towns had to actively choose to support this Kingdom of Heaven movement or reject it. It was a litmus test for the entire nation.
Here's where it gets really interesting. If this is an internal house cleaning, we need to look at the brooms he chose.
Yeah, the team.
Because if the mission parameters were intense, the internal team dynamics were an absolutely ideological powder keg.
Oh, without a doubt.
We just talked about how fractured the religious and political landscape was, right? You had the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Zealots, and Jesus builds his inner circle by pulling from absolute extremes.
Yeah.
He intentionally pairs Matthew with Simon the Zealot.
Which, in the context of the first century, is just a brilliant and terrifying combination.
Right. Because for you listening, think about who these two guys are. Matthew is a tax collector. We hear that today and think of like an IRS agent.
Just a boring bureaucrat.
Exactly. But in this society, tax collectors were viewed as traitorous collaborators with the Roman Empire. They bought franchises from Rome to collect taxes, and they made their profit by skimming off the top.
Yeah, it was brutal.
Matthew is the guy extorting his own starving neighbors to line his pockets and fund the very empire subjugating them.
He is literally the ultimate class traitor in the eyes of his community.
Exactly. And then you have Simon the Zealot. The Zealots were a radical, militant sect dedicated to the violent armed overthrow of the Roman Empire.
They were assassins, basically.
Pretty much. And they despised collaborators more than they despised the Romans. So you are essentially forcing a corrupt, traitorous state auditor and a militant anti-government revolutionary to share a tiny startup office.
Yeah.
Seriously, how did they not kill each other?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, that tension wasn't an accident. It was the point.
Really?
Yeah. This internal tension perfectly mirrored the external political tension of Judea. By bringing a collaborator and a violent revolutionary into the exact same inner circle, Jesus was proving his boundary-crossing authority.
It's like he's showing that his movement supersedes their deeply ingrained political hatred.
Exactly.
If the zealot can put down his dagger and the tax collector can walk away from his money, the movement has undeniable power.
Precisely. If he can command absolute opposites to drop their grudges and walk together without money or extra clothes into the wilderness, it underscores the sheer authority of this Kingdom of Heaven he is proclaiming.
That makes a lot of sense.
It proves that this new kingdom operates on rules completely alien to the Roman occupation or the local armed rebellions. It is an entirely different paradigm.
So what does this all mean for the actual boots on the ground? Because while the internal team somehow managed to hold together, the external threat they were marching into was a literal death sentence.
Yeah, there's no escaping that.
The text doesn't shy away from this at all. We keep saying Kingdom of Heaven. But in a land occupied by Rome, proclaiming any rival kingdom isn't just a cute spiritual metaphor.
No, not at all.
It is an inherently subversive act. It directly challenges Herodian legitimacy and Roman imperial dominance. It risks immediate charges of sedition.
Absolutely.
So if your goal is to spread a message of spiritual renewal, why use the kingdom language that guarantees a target on your back? It sounds like they are intentionally provoking the ultimate superpower of the ancient world.
Well, they were caught between a rock and a hard place, and the language of kingdom was an unavoidable provocation to both sides.
Okay, break that down for us.
The rock is the Roman legions. You know, governors like Pontius Pilate, who wouldn't hesitate to crush any hint of a rival king. Rome's answer to sedition was crucifixion.
Right.
But the hard place is the furious religious authorities. The local Jewish councils, known as the Sanhedrin, wielded significant power under an uneasy Roman tolerance.
And the Sanhedrin wasn't just being petty, right? I mean, they had a very pragmatic reason to be terrified of this movement.
Exactly. The Sanhedrin's peace treaty with Rome was incredibly fragile. Rome was always looking for an excuse to roll in the legions and just strip away whatever local autonomy the Jewish leaders had left.
Just wipe them out.
Right. So from the perspective of the religious elites, a rogue preacher sending out a dozen men to proclaim a new kingdom is a massive geopolitical liability.
Oh, totally.
They viewed this movement as a dangerous heresy that threatened to bring the wrath of Rome down on all of them.
And Jesus doesn't sugarcoat this for the 12. I mean, the warnings he gives them in chapter 10 are just brutal.
Very bleak.
He says they will be dragged before local councils. They will be scourged in synagogues. And scourging isn't just a slap on the wrist.
No, it's horrific.
It's a horrific, flesh-tearing whipping designed to bring a person to the brink of death. He tells them they will stand trial before Roman governors and kings. He explicitly tells them in verse 16, "Behold, I am sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves, so be wise as serpents and innocent as doves."
The drama of this text is rooted in that absolute certainty of suffering. There is no false promise of a comfortable life here.
None at all.
Jesus is positioning his disciples as the ultimate underdogs. They are prophetic upstarts armed with absolutely nothing but a message. No swords, no money, no political backing.
Just 12 guys.
Just 12 guys marching straight into the teeth of crushing Roman suppression and intense intra-Jewish strife.
It's a staggering psychological burden. I mean, to be a sheep among wolves means acknowledging your utter defenselessness while simultaneously possessing the wisdom of a serpent to navigate a society that is actively trying to destroy you.
It requires an immense psychological shift. You have to be shrewd enough to avoid unnecessary capture, but innocent enough not to resort to the very violence and corruption of the empire you were opposing.
Wow. But as terrifying as the Romans and the Sanhedrin were, the persecution wasn't just coming from the government or the religious elites.
No, it wasn't.
For me, looking at the source material, this is where the text hits the absolute hardest. The true drama, the most devastating part of this chapter, is that the danger was coming from inside the disciples' own home.
Yes. The ultimate social cost of the gospel.
Exactly. I want to look at verse 24 because I have to admit genuine shock on behalf of anyone reading this. Jesus declares, "Do not think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword."
It's a jarring statement.
It really is. He goes on to say that his message will painfully sever familial bonds. Sons will betray fathers. Daughters will betray mothers. We usually associate this historical figure with peace, love, and unity. Yet the text explicitly promises the destruction of family units. What is the actual day-to-day emotional toll on a listener living in an ancient society where family survival and honor meant literally everything?
Well, this raises an important question about the ancient Near Eastern honor-shame culture. We have to strip away our modern, Western, individualized view of the family.
Right, because we just think of the nuclear family.
Exactly. In first century Judea, your family wasn't just the people you ate dinner with. Your family was your economic safety net. They were your bank, your social identity, your physical protection, and your retirement plan.
Everything.
Everything. So to step outside of your family's religious and cultural norms wasn't just like an awkward disagreement at Thanksgiving. It was social suicide.
So when a son accepts this kingdom of heaven message and his father rejects it, he isn't just getting disowned emotionally. He is losing his livelihood, his trade, his protection.
It is a complete severing of the most foundational bond in their universe.
That's intense.
Very. The sword, Jesus mentions, isn't a literal weapon of war against Rome. It's the sharp dividing line that his message draws through the heart of the most intimate human relationships.
Wow.
The drama plays out in the destruction of these family units because the loyalty demanded by this new kingdom supersedes the absolute loyalty traditionally owed to the patriarchal family structure. Upending that honor-shame dynamic was the highest possible price a person could pay.
It's completely devastating. And he follows that up with a chilling warning. Jesus says that towns that reject this message, towns that refuse hospitality to these unburdened wandering disciples, face a divine judgment worse than Sodom.
Which functions as a heavy theological thread. But, you know, if you look at the historical timeline, it is also a perfect tragic foreshadowing.
Oh, definitely.
When you look at what actually happened just a few decades later in AD 70.
The destruction of Jerusalem.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The tragic, bloody destruction of Jerusalem and the temple by the Roman legions.
Yeah.
The tension that Jesus is navigating and warning about in Matthew 10 to our the refusal to accept a spiritual kingdom, the desperate clinging to violent political rebellion by factions like the Zealots, ultimately culminated in Rome burning the city to the ground.
Just total devastation.
Right. The judgment he is warning about isn't just abstract. It's a very real historical cliff that the nation is sprinting toward.
It really paints this entirely different picture. It's not just a religious sermon. It's a frantic, urgent warning.
Exactly.
He's sending out 12 unarmed guys to try and pull people back from the edge of a cliff, knowing full well that the very people they're trying to save are going to attack them for it.
And that brings us to something that really sits beneath all of this text.
Yeah.
If we look at the sheer weight of what we've covered today, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over.
Let's hear it.
We've seen how incredibly dangerous this message was. It shattered the ancient honor-shame culture and tore apart the economic and social safety net of the family.
Yeah.
It guaranteed brutal persecution from local religious councils and the overwhelming might of the Roman Empire. It required walking with absolutely nothing into a deeply hostile territory.
Basically a suicide mission.
Right. So what does it say about the sheer undeniable magnetism of this kingdom of heaven that 12 men, including a tax collector and a zealot who were sworn political enemies, still chose to walk straight into the teeth of the wolves anyway? What kind of profound authority compels a person to embrace a mission that guarantees a target on their back?
Man, that is the ultimate question this text leaves us wrestling with. The psychological reality of choosing that path, of leaving behind your family and your security for a promise of a sword and a cross, is just staggering.
It really is.
Now, I want to turn this over to you. Yes, you listening to this right now. We covered some incredibly intense historical drama today.
A lot of heavy stuff.
Oh, absolutely. We looked at the volatile political tension between the Roman Empire and the local religious authorities. We explored the shocking, visceral destruction of the ancient family unit and the sheer terror of being an unarmed sheep among Roman wolves.
Yeah.
I want to know, what stood out to you the most about the political tension in first century Judea? How would you have reacted to being handed that kind of impossible mission briefing?
I know how to run the other way.
Right. Drop a comment below and let us know your thoughts on how these 12 men navigated being caught between a rock and a hard place.
We'd love to read them.
Also, if you enjoyed this deep dive into the gritty reality of historical texts, please make sure to like and subscribe to the show so you never miss out on our investigations. Your support is what allows us to keep pulling back the curtain on these fascinating historical moments.
It really helps the show.
It does. And don't forget to check the description below for exclusive links we've gathered just for you, expanding on everything we covered today.
So really great resources down there.
For sure. Finally, brace yourselves, because if you thought the political powder keg of Matthew 10 was wild, the next deep dive is going to be even more intense. We'll see then.